Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour and to our 2024 tribute to Martin Luther King. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The music you're listening to is from a song called Revolution by Arrested Development. It was originally recorded for use in Spike Lee's biopic of Malcolm X. In recognition of MLK Day, we have for you today a commentary from Black author and professor of sociology Gary Young on race, racism, and the politics of identity. We'll close out our show with Bill Resnick speaking with Black radical author and activist Malik Mia about the right-wing assault on teaching about race and racism. In between, Norm Diamond speaks with local playwright Maya Milan Gonzalez about Milagro Theater's current production of Huelga, a play in the tradition of social justice theater about the activist Dolores Huerta. Our music this morning draws from 6 decades of Black resistance music, from the 1960s recording of Young, Gifted, and Black, to more recent songs in response to the ongoing police murders of Black and brown people. You won't hear programming like this on corporate commercial radio, so if you like what you hear, consider supporting KBOO, your volunteer-powered community radio station. You can find a donate button at kboo.fm. Your support makes a difference. Today is the national holiday that recognizes the towering achievements of one of the most important civil rights activists of the 20th century. Tributes to Martin Luther King, however, nearly always erase or sanitize his radical politics. MLK was acutely aware of and spoke out about issues of class as well as race, and he was a staunch critic of the U.S. Imperial War in Vietnam. This morning, in honor of his memory, we would like to expand on the politics of identity, race, and racism, and how identity politics alone, including the politics of racial identity, is an insufficient response to the moment. Gary Young is an award-winning author and professor of sociology at University of Manchester in Great Britain. His most recent book, Dispatches from the Diaspora, investigates decades of the Black diaspora, from the first presidential campaign of Nelson Mandela to the Black Lives Matter movement. Gary Young claims Black, working class, middle class, male, heterosexual, professional, and British identities all at once. What, he asks in this commentary, does that matter? What does it mean for a politics that seeks to dismantle a racist, sexist, anti-gay, and imperial world order? This commentary was originally published by Double Down News, a progressive online journal. Now, here is Gary Young.
What is it about being British that matters to you? What is it about being Black that matters to you? What is it about being working class that matters to you? Because any one of those categories, Black, working class, British, contains a lot of really awful people. Identity is a very important place to start, but it's a terrible place to finish. And that's where some people, or too many people, that's where they end their story. I'm this, and I'm not going to talk about anything else. I'm lots of things. I'm Black and British. I was working class. I am middle class. I'm a journalist. I'm a professor. I'm straight. I'm male. And I'm also just one thing, Gary. Race never operates alone. It operates with a bunch of rogue characters, class, gender, sexual orientation, region, ability. It is one identity among many. And actually, to try and understand race without those other aspects is to misunderstand it completely. Race isn't real. We think we know what it is. But actually, what it is a social construct. to understand the world that racism built. If you look at people's genetic makeup, 99% of it is all the same. But thanks primarily to the slave trade, there had to be a rationale for why some people were enslaved and other people weren't. And so they came up with a logic that the people who were enslaved were less like people. They were less intelligent, they were less human, and therefore there was a range of things that you could do with them. Now, this doesn't have to be about color. Racism isn't just black and white. It can operate in all sorts of contexts. I would call it racism against the Irish. They were white. British people were white. But when it came down to it, when people came to this country in the 50s and 60s, said no dogs, no blacks, no Irish. So racism is always better understood as a system than as a set of personal values. There is this effort, this crude, nasty effort, not to see our differences, because there are differences. There are cultural, racial, national differences. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with discriminating between people. I have this problem with discriminating against people. Actually, recognizing difference is a very important thing. Actually, the space for that has become more and more narrow for understanding people and moments for what they are and for what is common about them as opposed to the things that make us different. Race may be a construct. Racism is a reality. From cradle to grave, more likely to die in infancy, more likely to die in pregnancy, more likely to be expelled, less likely to get a job on graduation if you're lucky enough to go to university, more likely to be unemployed, more likely to suffer mental health problems, more likely to be poorly housed. In all sorts of ways, black people fall not just foul of the law of the land, they fall foul of the law of probabilities. And this is not an accident. The most daily, banal forms of racism, the institutional, systemic racism, the racism that you can't share on a video, but it's the racism that we live with every day. And then at the end, there's Black Lives Matter, which shows that the ability of America to put a black man in the White House is no longer contested. But the ability of a black youth to walk down the street and not get shot dead, the ability of a black man to be questioned and not murdered, that's still an open question. And so there's a range of ways in which clearly things have got better. And it would be a disservice to the people who campaigned and worked hard to make those things better to suggest that that isn't true. But there are even more things that have stayed the same or got worse. While symbols are not insubstantial, they should not be confused with substance either. We have to be in a constant state of vigilance about what advances are truly symbolic and what advances are truly substantial and what advances are in the trajectory of becoming substantial. If we don't do that, we run the risk of dismissing everything that is gained. What does it matter if a black man becomes president? But if we don't have a critical eye on it, then you get people claiming it as everything. That Obama's victory proves that black people can be equal. That the fact that we have a brown prime minister shows X, Y, Z. They do nothing of the sort. When I interviewed Angela Davis, she says there is an understanding of diversity as the difference that brings no difference and the change that brings no change. Which is a very powerful notion, that you can look different and act the same. And if we think about racism as a system, then actually, if the system's working, it doesn't matter whose hands are on it. It could be black hands, it could be brown hands, it could be white hands. If that wasn't evident before, it should be from the awful business that happened in Memphis, where most of the cops were black. But once you have a system of policing in place, that no longer becomes quite the contradiction that people think it is. And so what matters is to change the system. Often the successes are individual and the setbacks are collective, but not always. And quite often, the successes that are individual speak to some collective advance, that the individual would not have been able to make that move without the collective progress. And almost always, the individual successes of middle-class black people in the West are intimately and intricately related to the advances that are made among working class people. But those working class black people generally aren't the ones who benefit. Arundhati Roy has a great analogy of the Thanksgiving turkey in America. Every year, the president pardons one turkey. And that turkey is not fried, it goes back to the turkey farm. She's talking about the handful of people who managed to get through. And she compares them to the Thanksgiving turkey that is pardoned. And she says, all the rest, they're all for the pan. But one turkey gets through. And then people say, how can turkeys be against Thanksgiving? That one's fine. And so they highlight on the individual one that gets through and use them when they're the exception and they assert that they are the rule. You know, it's only really stupid or arrogant people who think they do it all by themselves. There are people who went before me who created the space that made me possible. They didn't do it for me. The tragedy is a large number of the people who created that space didn't benefit from that space, which is why I feel that there is a responsibility in my work. I grew up black in a town where most people were white and working class. My life has taken a fortunate turn. I feel a relationship to the working class, but I'm not of them anymore. I feel a relationship to the middle class, but I don't feel entirely of them. I feel a relationship to black people, but I didn't grow up around that many of them. That's been a learned relationship. I feel British, but I also didn't grow up feeling British. And so I've grown with a sense that my people are my community and they can be anywhere. And that was a gift that British racism gave to me, really, because I grew up with people going, it's pretty cold, isn't it? But it's not like this where you come from. And think, well, I come from just down the road. But obviously that doesn't work for you. So I'm going to have to imagine, well, you know, we supported Wales for rugby and Brazil at football and West Indies at cricket. We never supported England growing up. That's quite a new thing for me. So in all of these ways, I would fly a flag of convenience and had to kind of construct my identity as I went along. And that didn't come from a position of strength. And there's a range of ways in which I wish it had been easier, but I was glad for it. It forced me to think.
That was a clip from the song Young, Gifted, and Black with lyrics by Weldon Irvine and sung by Nina Simone. It was a song which Gary Young is about to explain that he grew up with. Here is the conclusion of Young's commentary.
One of the main inspirations in my journalism and my life is my mum. My mum came to this country when she was 18, 19, British passport, from Barbados. She's going to be a nurse. She was sent up to Derby. She meets my dad. They have three kids. I'm the youngest. Then my dad leaves when I'm one. She's a psychiatric nurse. We'd moved to Stevenage. Yes, she's got these three kids. And it's the early 70s, which racially is not a great time in Britain. She used to play Young, Gifted and Black. She'd say, oh, they're playing our song. And she had to build this notion from thin air, really, about whom we might be, about what might be possible. There were very few possibilities. It was always assumed that we would go to university. She didn't go to university. Most of my mates from school didn't go to university, but it was always assumed that we would by her. She was a feminist. She was an anti-colonialist. She was a socialist. She would never have used any of those words about herself. And yet those were the principles that were inculcated into me. She did a lot of youth work. Now, Stevenage is overwhelmingly white. She would say, these are our people. She made me stay up and watch the Holocaust miniseries. And she was like, these are your people. Like, this is your story too. She had that kind of very militant sense of humanism. And then a lot of racist stuff would go down and she would have to intervene and be like, well, what's going on here? You know, why are you treating my kid like that? That's not on. And so I was raised with this sense that the space that you were going to occupy in the world hasn't been defined yet. You're going to have to define it. That the plans for you that exist do not do you justice. So you must make plans for yourself. And then my mum died when I was 19 and she was 44, very young. And even in her death, there were these lessons. And one was, like, life is short and frail. And I felt like my mum did what she needed to do while she was on the planet and bequeathed to me and my brothers, you need to do what you need to do while you're on the planet. You don't know how long you're going to be here. There's a bit of me that can go a bit Oprah Winfrey because I am an unlikely thing. When my mum was padding around the house with me singing Young, Gifted and Black, she couldn't have imagined the life that I would have as a journalist. I picketed the South African embassy with my mum. She couldn't have imagined that 8 years later I would be traveling with Mandela's cavalcade, hanging around with his bodyguard. She couldn't have imagined that. And so I'm the product of an unlikely journey. Now, as a professor, that wasn't in the stars at all. And that does shape my feeling that the world we want to build, maybe we can't see it yet, but we have to believe that it's possible. In the same way that Martin Luther King didn't go up to the steps of Lincoln Memorial and say, I have a 10-point plan. He said, I have a dream. And then he dreamt of something that no one could have thought was possible in that moment. That engaged people in a very particular way. And so when I think about the future, I think it could be rational to despair. Global warming, stagnant wages, rising xenophobia. But then you look at the strikes. And then you look at the anti-racist movement, and you look at the range of ways in which people are fighting back. And it's my decision, in a way, my personal decision, not to despair, but to embrace that spirit that my mum had when she had me padding around the house and couldn't see what my future would be, but had to believe in it, to believe that we have a better future. And so I feel that I'm the product of a certain kind of hope. There is a phrase that the realists often use, which is, politics is the art of the possible. And I like to think that radicalism is the art of imagining different possibilities and then fighting for the world that you want. Going beyond just what we can see, which is often inadequate. Thinking Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator and radical, said, what can we do today so that tomorrow we can do what we couldn't do today? And that's the essential of activism. You can't just imagine a world and conjure it into life. But if you don't imagine the world that you want to live in, then where are you going? And the world that I want to live in, I can't see it right now, but I know that it's possible. I feel that it's possible. And that's enough for me.
We must begin to tell our young.
There's a world waiting for you.
Yours is the quest that's just begun.
That was a little more of Nina Simone's version of Young, Gifted, and Black. Before that, you heard a commentary by Gary Young on race, racism, and identity, originally published on YouTube by Double Down News. A link to the commentary can be found on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. We turn now to Norm Diamond, speaking today with local playwright and actor Maya Milan Gonzalez. Her theater piece, playing now at Milagro Theater, is called Huelga, or Strike. It explores the lifelong activism of Dolores Huerta. The story is told in the tradition of activist and social justice theater that comes out of the California farmworkers' struggle of years past.
This is Norm Diamond. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. My guest this morning is Maya Milan Gonzalez. Maya comes actually from theater royalty. She was literally born in the theater. Her parents are the founders of Milagro Theater, where Maya has a play as the author that just opened this weekend. The play is called Huelga. In English, that means strike. And it is about the life of Dolores Huerta, the co-founder with Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers. Good morning, Maya. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here this morning and to talk about Huelga. I love KBOO and I'm so excited.
Well, even before we talk about Huelga, I want to talk about you a little bit. You do pretty much everything in the theater. One of the ways you characterize yourself is as a teatrista. Sorry.
Yes. Teatrista.
Which means, of course, theater person, but the word itself, you've explained to me, comes out of a very particular social justice theater tradition in this country. So you're a performer, You're a playwright, and beyond all that, you're a teatrista. Tell us
Yes.
about that and about that tradition.
Yeah, well, teatrista is something that a lot of Spanish-speaking countries in Latin America and Mexico might not be familiar with because it is rooted in the US Latino experience. In this country, we have teatros, which literally is a Spanish translation of theater, just in Spanish, right? But it has a special meaning in this country. It means it's a theater that is specifically devoted to doing culturally specific Latino theater, to telling Latino stories. And so these teatros within them, like a lot of smaller, non-culturally specific theaters, are generally underfunded, which generally means that it's kind of an all hands on deck mentality. We all come together because we're creating a show, not just for laughs and ha-has, but really for a deeper social justice mission, right? For a deeper mission of representation, of letting the American theater, the greater American theater, know that that also includes Latino stories, that teatros and that tradition is just as much a part of American theater. And in these teatros, right, like I said, it's all hands on deck. So you may be writing a play, you may be acting in a play, you may be directing a play. There's a light that needs to be refocused. So somebody grab a ladder because I'm going to go up there really quick and just refocus that light. So the tradition of teatrista is really, it's a greater meaning beyond just like, oh, I do a lot of things in theater. It also is rooted in the teatro movement and the movement of social justice theater.
You remind me actually of that quote from Karl Marx about what socialism would be like. There'd be fishing in the morning and reading in the afternoon and a study group in the evening and also productive work as part of the day. And so you do pretty much everything. It's really interesting to me. There's a confluence now in speaking with you and in thinking about the play that you've just authored and that we're going to see sometime very shortly. And that is that this tradition got a big boost. The tradition you're talking about, Teatro tradition, got a big boost in connection with organizing the farm workers in California, didn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, in the 1960s, El Teatro Campesino, which is, one of the oldest teatros in this country, was founded on the picket lines of the Great Grape Strike with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. It was Dolores Huerta who invited Luis Valdez to come see what they were doing. And then Luis went to Cesar and said, I want to start a theater company. And he said, there's no money for that. So if you want to do that, like you can do it on the side, but like we're strike all day, right? And so in this moment, in this big social justice time, right? I mean, the 1960s, there was so much happening. The Brown Berets were exploding, the Black Panther movement, women's liberation. And so it really was a Chicano revolution that was happening. And El Teatro Campesino was kind of one of the seeds that we acknowledge in terms of theatrical history in this country.
This
And so
theater.
it was really great in doing this show to pay homage to Teatro Campesino through their methodology and utilizing that in the storytelling.
And do they make an appearance in the play?
The actual theater company?
No. I mean, some reference to them. I
Oh,
get
yes,
it.
they do actually. I do. I reference them in a very tongue-in-cheek kind of way, utilizing the methodology of the actos. There's a moment in the play where some scabbers, some esquiroles, right, folks who are crossing the picket line, are talking, and they're talking about all these things that, this Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta are doing. And along the way, they go, and I hear they got theater, and so it's my nod to the root of Chicano theater.
I wish our listeners could see Maya as I see her as she's talking. Clearly, a performer as well.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind.
Very active with your hands.
I'm very gestural.
I had not been aware that it was Dolores Huerta who invited Luis Valdez and the Teatro Campesino, and that's the origin story there. So let's
Yeah.
move and tell us about the play that you've written and about Dolores Huerta.
It is a very interactive show. It's not your typical, ignoring of the audience and like we're having these dramatic scenes. It very much includes the audience and it's talking with the audience throughout the piece. I kind of, it's about an hour show. So Dolores Huerta is 93. It is very hard to put her entire life and all of the achievements and all of the big things she's done in an hour show. So there's definitely some jumping through history, but I go on the history from the 1960s when she left her first husband, Ralph Head, to her journey up to essentially the end of the play is back in 20. Oh no, what's the year? I can't think of it in my head right now. Back in the aughts when President Obama awarded her the National Medal.
Wow.
And so, we go on journeys throughout, and I wanted to have a balance in telling her story about not just the career accomplishments that she's had, but also acknowledge her family life and how she balanced so often in her time being a single mother of 11 children while traveling across the world, spreading new, like spreading information about the challenges that they were facing, be it within the UFW and the Great Grape Strike, or, later in life when she continued working for other causes, women's, like I said, women's liberation, gender equality, all the things. And she's still, again, at 93 today, you can look her up and she's probably got an interview somewhere that you can catch next week, a lecture she's doing. Like she's nonstop. She still goes down to the picket lines. Just recently, I think last year, the LA schools were protesting, striking, and she went down and she was there. And so she is non the woman is nonstop. And I think that is one of the most incredible goals that a person could have is to look at someone who's 93 years old and still going.
I have to ask, did you talk with her in creating the play? And is she going to see it?
I hope she sees it. I did not get to talk to her directly. I have in various before I was even commissioned for this play, I had fortunately the opportunity to have a few conversations with her. But that was just as an interested person in her and getting to talk. And she has a very close relationship with some of my family members. So it was really through them that I was able to get first count of stories of my in-laws have known her since 1965, so they have a really long history with her, and I really got to get a lot of personal stories. The majority of this play was actually written in 2020 during the pandemic. So I originally wrote it as just a Zoom play, and then fortunately this year Milagro wanted to produce it in person. So I had the opportunity to go back through the script, go back through some old interviews that I hadn't gotten to, I didn't have access to the first round, and dive a little deeper in the story. But it's, yeah, it was mostly written in a time of solace, of quarantine, and just, me and my partner in our little bubble.
That turns out to have been a good time for writing as a
Yeah, it really
solitary
was.
activity. Yeah, for a lot of people. What can you tell us about this particular production? How's rehearsal going? And now the play's underway, of course, and
Yeah, well, I think what's really exciting about this particular production, aside from the fact that this is, I mean, the world premiere in person, is really Lawrence Ilagi. He really captured the essence of what this show is physically. It's kind of everything all together. There's incredible projections that highlight the archival history of some of these moments, these marches. There's music that was really important to me, was to have live music of the corridos of the era, because that is so much a part. Again, when we were talking earlier about El Teatro Campesino, like Luis Valdez, a lot of his, I have a few of his songs in there. that he granted me permission to use, because so much of the teatro's influence in the Great Grape Strike was through singing, was through the actos, but really, like when they did the march to Sacramento, the thing that kept people going was the songs along the way. And these songs are full of stories, and they're so integral to getting the message across, right? We want to spread word of what's happening. So let's make a song that we can then sing and tell the whole story. So it was really important to me to have that. And Lawrence just really understood immediately the style of the show. We had Luis Valdez's son, Lakin Valdez, my partner, came, and he did a Vibrant Being Theater of the Sphere. It's El Teatro Campesino's methodology workshop, really giving the actors that firsthand experience of what is the actor history and what is that methodology. So that's really unique that these actors in the Pacific Northwest got the opportunity to really dive into those roots.
As potential audience member, that's actually exciting that we too will be in touch with that bigger tradition through the
Yeah.
play. The labor aspects, of course, but now the social justice theater aspects. I'm really looking forward to it. You've a few times now used the word acto, and the play is being described as a super acto. Tell us what that means, and do we look forward to a little bit of audience participation as part of this?
Oh, I hope so. I hope the audience participates. But so an acto is a methodology that was established by El Teatro Campesino. Acto is the Spanish translation, which means act. And essentially, in the early days of the strike, after spending all day working and picketing and doing all the things, Luis Valdez got together with a group of campesinos, huelguistas, right? Folks who were striking and who had no theater training because they were campesinos. And he said, let's do skits to tell the story of what we're going through. So let's do a skit, and you're going to be the boss, the patroncito, and you're going to be the campesino who's not making any money. You're going to be the coyote, the person who like is bringing in the campesinos to the boss. And through this art form, a couple different things happened. One is that actors, campesinos, became emboldened and found power when they were acting as the bosses. And they realized, wow, I have power. These actos also encouraged scabbers, esquiroles, to go, you know what? Maybe it is actually in my best interest to leave the fields and join the union.
Scabs also attended some of the performances.
Well, the performances were done on the picket lines. So you'd have, the huelguistas, the strikers going back and forth with their picket signs. And then you'd have this flatbed truck that a bunch of the actors would jump up on and in the middle do these actos, right? To encourage folks. They'd also do them at the end of meetings. So folks would come in, they'd check out, I'm going to check out this meeting, see what's going on. And then the meeting ends in a show and they're like, wow, this is actually kind of fun. There's music, there's things happening. And so the acto style is very specific. It's not just small little skits. It embraces a style akin to, not the same, but akin to commedia dell'arte, and that you have these archetypes. One of my favorite things about the acto is it's really not pedestrian in art form. And when I say pedestrian, I mean, we have a way that we walk about the world and talk to each other. It's a little bit more cartoonish. It's a little bit more satirized. Satirizing the opponent is kind of like one of the key, is it what the actual S stands for in Actos, is satirizing the opponent. And so it really embraces this kind of bombastic art form to blow up the problem to then show what is the solution. So in my show, being called a super acto is actually a term that Jorge Huerta coined. He's kind of like the father of Chicano scholars in theater. And so, An acto, like I said, is generally a skit. It's like a little scene, whereas my play is an hour long. So it's like many little actos tied together to create this super acto.
Wonderful. The play is called Huelga. It's at Milagro, at Miracle Theater. This has been Maya Malan Gonzalez. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and actually seeing you in person, and look forward to seeing you when you come to town later to perform later in the year
Oh,
as
thank
well.
you so much, Norm. It's been so fantastic talking to you and getting to know you and hearing how our paths have crossed in the past.
We have many stories in common. We're not going to tell the listenership, but when I said that Maya was born into the theater, I meant that very literally. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour with our wonderful guest, Maya Malan Gonzalez. Thank you, Maya.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, everyone.
In this world and good in the life to come, keep us safe from the torment of the fire as we keep our hands up high and scream for justice. Ferguson, rest in peace, Mike Brown, and all the young soldiers out there. God help us.
Time to take a stand and save our future.
Like we all got shot, we all got shot.
Throwing up our hands, don't let them shoot us.
Cause we all we got, we all we got. God ain't put us on the earth to get mad, it's murder.
That clip was from a song called Don't Shoot, composed and sung by a group of rappers recruited by The Game to respond to the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson in 2014. Before that, you heard Norm Diamond speaking with Maya Malan Gonzalez. Her play about Dolores Huerta is playing now at Milagro Theater here in Portland through January 27. Tickets are available at milagro.org. You are listening to your community radio station, KBOO, in Portland. White supremacist assaults on academic freedom and campus freedom of speech have accelerated in the context of the crisis in Gaza and took an ugly racist turn with the recent forcing out of Claudine Gay, the first Black female president of Harvard. To close our show today, Bill Resnick speaks with radical activist and author Malik Mia about the right-wing attacks on education and how we can organize against them.
Hello, Malik Mayo. Welcome again to KBOO.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Malik Mayo is a longtime Black civil rights and revolutionary socialist and labor activist, made his living as an aviation mechanic, co-wrote the books The Assassination of Malcolm X, also Angola, The Hidden History of Washington's War, and exhibited a chapter of the book, The National Black Independent Political Party, An Important Step Forward for Blacks and Other American Workers. He's now a contributing editor with Against the Current on the advisory board of Links International Journal of Socialist Renewal. He has published several pieces recently in Green Left Weekly and Against the Current, and recently published several articles, Why Critical Race Theory is Important, and In Defense of Being Awake, which, of course, Malik's pun is on being woke, that is, being progressive, in defense of progressivism. So, Malik, earlier this month, the authoritarian far right achieved another significant victory in their campaign to eliminate teaching anything that contradicts their white supremacist gospel. When they forced the resignation of Claudine Gay, aided by a set of super rich donors who threatened the university with withholding many millions of dollars. And before that, last year, the far right had shaken up the entire public school system, winning legislation in many Republican controlled states that made it a crime to teach about racism that the right insists no longer exists. In each case, it was front page news denounced by teachers' unions and the ACLU as full of misinformation and lies. But the authoritarians, they laughed it off because it was serving them pretty well. At the end of the interview, we'll discuss how they can be defeated. We do have potential strengths. But first, tell us what's happening. Tell us about the right-wing aims and means and context in which they're doing it.
Yes, thanks. It's important that we understand that the attack on Gay and other university presidents and professors is rooted in a long-term campaign of the far right, the mega Republicans and conservatives that began soon after the civil rights laws were adopted in the late 60s. It's taken different names, but today its main name is against affirmative action, or what they call DEI, which is shorthand for diversity, equity, and inclusion in all forms of life. Since Claudine Gay was the first African-American woman to be president of Harvard, one of the oldest, probably the oldest university in the United States, they had all called her unqualified because she was there because of affirmative action, or DEI, as they call it, and she shouldn't be in that position. They took advantage of the campaign on college campuses around support of Palestine in the current war, Israel against the Palestinian people, and used that to go after her and others, saying they were allowing people to be anti-Semitic, which was not the case. They were talking about free speech and the right of anyone to express their opinions. So they took that issue. A right-wing House Republican committee went after her and the other presidents at Ivy League schools and demanded basically that they denounce these efforts and to basically get people fired from their jobs if they were professors or students lose their scholarships. And she refused to go along with that. And one of the most hedge fund Harvard alumni who led this charge along with the MAGA Republicans even went so far as to say that she only got her position because she was black, because of a race-related curriculum. Now, it's important to point out, and this is true with most African-Americans and others who get jobs in higher academia or anywhere, they're highly qualified, have to be. Whatever mistakes or anything they may have said or didn't do, one charge was plagiarism, which was not really true. But whatever charge that's made against them, they always come back to one issue. They're not qualified because of their skin color or their ethnic background. They're so arrogant, they even said afterwards that we took her scalp, which anyone knows American history, the killing of indigenous people, which was the first real Holocaust in this country. They know what that meant. Unfortunately, this campaign is spreading, but fortunately, Gay herself has pushed back. And I'd like to just briefly quote a New York Times op-ed she wrote a couple of days ago, which I think summarizes the essence of what's going on. She said, "The campaign against me was about more than one university and one leader. This was merely a single skirmish in a broader war to unravel public face and pillars of American society. Campaigns of this kind often start with attacks on education and expertise because these are the tools that best equip communities to see through the propaganda," end of quote. And that's exactly what it is. This campaign, which most people may be familiar with what the Governor DeSantis did in Florida when he went after what he called wokeism, was directed at ending affirmative action in the Florida school system. But it quickly spread to public libraries. He even went after Disney Corporation because it defended the right of gays to function in society. So it starts with public education, it spreads to other institutions, and the ultimate goal is to return to a society where white supremacy, not openly stated, but is in practice, is the rule of the land. And that any black, Latino, any woman, any gay person is put in the back, is told to shut up and accept that reality. So in my view, this Claudine Gay situation helped highlight what's been going on for the last several years and opens the door to change. Now, it's important to recognize that all this also happened, not just because of Florida, because what the U.S. Supreme Court did last year, July 2023, when the court ruled that we are a quote-unquote colorblind country, which is not true. As a colorblind country, you can't have diversity. You cannot have affirmative action. You cannot have any recognition of the reality of American history. You cannot explain that the Founding Fathers did not include black people since they were slaves in the Constitution. It did not include indigenous people who were not even considered people. They were not even allowed to be called citizens till the 20th century. So that was the Founding Fathers. That was their view of America. It was the settlers from Europe. They were the only citizens. Everybody else were not. And then even if you became a citizen later, you were second class. So this is a continuation of the founding of this country. We've had pushbacks and you get some gains, then they fight back. So now we're in a new stage, as Bill said. We'll talk more about what should be done later in this discussion. But this fight around higher education, public education, is very much tied to the broader fight for equality in the United States.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Malik Mia, a longtime Black civil rights and revolutionary socialist and labor activist. We're discussing the right-wing attack now on the public schools, on public universities, and in fact, in government as a whole, and particularly, of course, of the people who made the civil rights revolution in the 60s, and they're trying to eliminate it, the authoritarian right. Let's talk about that a little bit, that the right is on a roll and believes it will not be defeated, and they have developed a ground game of determined people who will, in fact, go at every school board member who doesn't like their line. They make life miserable for anybody that they point the finger at, and it's really intimidating teachers, even in the universities with better salaries, especially people with mortgages and precarious positions, get intimidated, and in fact, they either change their line or have to leave. Talk about the position of those people who have been trolled and who are then receiving death threats. It's very intimidating, and it forces people into positions that they have really very little choice and really standing up to the right. Tell us about that and the pressures that people feel.
Yes, and I think it's important that some of the people they've gone after, like Claudine Gay, in the higher academia, you know, she has her job. She was a professor, still is a professor at Harvard. She has tenure. She has more protection than many others. In fact, she was the dean of the largest school at Harvard before she got her position. And she also taught at Stanford. So she had all the credentials and records, and they went after her. And part of what the media doesn't report, part of the campaign against her, is to use the N-word constantly, the smear. So the racism is there openly about who she is. But then think about somebody who's just an untenured professor at a university or city college. They're in a much weaker ground even to speak out like she has. They can lose their position overnight. Even if it's a public school, they can be forced out and not be allowed to continue to teach. So as you said, many people, this is their income, the way they live. And so while many of them are fighting back no matter what, even if they lose their positions, a lot of people had their jobs taken away over the Palestine issue and over affirmative action, which is a positive thing that they're willing to fight. But on the other hand, as you said, people have to live. How do they survive? I know in Florida, many professors and others who were in like African studies or other kind of programs have had to leave the state. They just applied and went to other states, to other colleges. They couldn't just stay there since they were going to lose their positions. Well, you can only do that up to a certain extent. Most people just, what they do is self-discipline themselves. That is, they don't talk about the issue. They just keep quiet. They won't tell their students why it's wrong, what the governor is doing, or what the Congress is doing. So that self-discipline, self-censorship is a big problem. And you see that in public libraries, too. If a librarian doesn't like having 100 books taken out of the library and speaks out, they can lose their job. So part of this whole campaign is to force people to stay silent, not to resist, and hopefully that's how they win. But again, lesson of history is that can only work for so long. You know, you can do that, but if people begin to say no and to fight back, you can change the dynamic. And I think some of that is already beginning to happen. The teachers unions have done it in public school, but they, you know, more has to be done. Because the right wing goes to public, they do recalls against people once they get elected. They'll go recall people, not just in public education, in all positions. Here in I'm in Northern California, in the San Francisco area, we have several recalls petitions going on to try to take out people who are not really radicals. They're just people who are more liberal than what they should be in the eyes of the right. So the one tactic they use here is to start getting petitions to go after people, even if they just got elected. I mean, literally, it could be elected on Monday, then Tuesday, there's a recall petition put out. So there's many weapons the right is using to try to silence anyone who speaks up. And, you know, you're not going to defeat them through some electoral approach. You're going to have to fight them in the same way they're fighting and expose them. One point I should make, and it's an important one, the media is complicit in all this right-wing stuff. most of the mainstream media reports these debates as though there's two sides to the issue. That is, both sides have problems, when in fact there's only a right-wing side and people trying to figure out how to respond to them. So instead of exposing and attacking them, they will just try to say, well, this is one side. Claudine Gay may have plagiarized, which she didn't really, because anyone knows about writing articles or publications or books. You have references, and you can try to pretend that that reference didn't cover everything that was said. That would mean every academic book, every book that's been written would probably be called plagiarized by that definition. But that's what they do. That's what the right does. And then the media gives them cover. You know, they give cover to Trump. They give cover to those who are racist. This attack on Gay, these attacks on public education, they're more than racist, but the root cause is racism because of the history of white supremacy in this country.
So far, Malik, we've talked about the power of the right and their attack strategy, which silences a lot of people, but it can be defeated. I think the way we can approach it is they have developed a very effective ground game that is in localities, but also at the national level. They have cooked up many, many people, many working class people, people from every station, who believe that the enemy is racial, it's gay people, it's liberals trying to teach our children that the U.S. is not the citadel of democracy, that the U.S. has been complicit in a lot of terrible action against democracy all over the world. It's very clear, even right now, they're complicit in genocide, although Biden is a little bit nervous about that. He still is selling their 2,000-pound bombs to use on civilians. In any event, the right has coked up these people to, in fact, attack. And they have a ground game. They have a movement. Of course, it's based on hideous premises and is vulnerable for that. Ultimately, people will understand it. It seems to me, though, the only way to defeat them is our own ground game that will overpower them. And I think it's possible. The American public actually likes its public schools. There's lots of impulses in ordinary people towards rejecting the right. And it seems to me we have to build a ground game that's more powerful than theirs, who will, in fact, go out and organize to defeat them.
Yes, I agree. The key to this is not to get caught up in the moment in the sense of some of the gains the right have made, but is to take a more historical approach to how to defeat what's taking place. I always like to explain to people is look at the civil rights movement or civil rights revolution. When the civil rights movement began, it really began in the earlier 20th century after the start of Jim Crow segregation. And very few people understood that the issues that were raised by the early leaders around just basic individual rights for black people could be the way to build a broad movement. But it did, and against lynching. That was lynching was a common thing in the South and in this country. So that movement that began in the teens, it developed slowly, but by the time of the Second World War and afterwards, it became a mass movement. And that mass in the 50s was mainly African Americans itself in the communities, but then it began to be progressive-minded liberal whites started to support it. But you always had this contradiction. The contradiction was the blacks, and people are familiar with Martin Luther King. He would say the tactic they used was nonviolent disobedience, but he understood that you couldn't rely on the system to win. You couldn't rely on elected politicians. You couldn't rely on anything but your own actions and reaching out to others. And he also understood that you couldn't, when you were told to wait, you were told to slow down because of the backlash by racists or the powerful. He ignored it. He just continued to organize and mobilize. And then finally, we get the laws in the 60s. And it's important to remember that it was two Democratic politicians who were the president, JFK and Johnson, who told them to slow down even then. But finally, they recognized the movement was so large that they passed the big, important civil rights and voting rights laws. Okay, but that was a long process of struggle. And at a time when most whites, liberal whites, didn't think it could go all the way in segregation in the South. They didn't believe it. They thought you could modify it, but you couldn't end it. But a mass struggle made that possible. I think that kind of movement has to begin now around these issues. That is, you have to organize, make clear positions on racism, sexism, anti-gay bigotry, all the issues that were, some gains were made, and say these have to be reintroduced, adopted. The 50-year-old abortion rights needs to be reinstated by Congress or the courts. Doesn't matter. You make your demands against the system. Civil rights, voting rights has to be reinstated. And I should make a point about voting rights. Right now, voting rights are being taken away in all the states. People think, well, the voting rights, just the MAGA. No. Every state, they're making it harder for people to vote. When you make it hard to vote, they mainly target black people. And then it goes to Latino people. Then it goes to, you know, students and liberals. That's already happening. Most of these states that once were Jim Crow are passing laws. So even if you try to vote, you have the majority. Your vote may not be counted. So that's what we're dealing with. But the lesson is to go back and look at how it was won in the past, build a movement like that again, directed at both parties, not just the Republicans, but the Democrats who'd like to say, wait, we'll deal with it, slow down, don't fight back, and then push it and push it hard. If that happens, we can make gains, and it will happen. The reason I know it will happen because it's happened in the past. But I don't focus on the 2024 elections. A lot of people say, well, we got to make sure Trump doesn't get reelected. Well, that's the wrong approach. The civil rights movement never said, let's focus on electing LBJ while they were fighting for civil rights. There were some liberals who said that. King and others just ignored it. They kept pushing hard. That's got to be the same approach in 2024. Push for what's right. Whatever happens with the election will happen, and the fight will continue in the non-electoral form for victories to be won. So that's how I see what needs to be done. I think it will happen, but there will be many who will try to derail the movement as it begins to grow, because they'll say, stop demonstrating, vote for Biden, who is not really a Democrat, by the way, small d. I mean, he says that, but what has he really done for black people, Latino, in reality over the last 3 years? What is he really doing for migrants? What is he really doing for people around the world, particularly in the Middle East, where he ignores the slaughter of Palestinians? So his movement, his campaign will do what it will do. We should just do what we have to do, which is to fight on the issues and demand that the government, city, state, and federal, take the correct positions.
Alec Mia, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
And that does it for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Norm Diamond, and Bill Resnick for their contributions, John Nelson for his editing assistance, and especially to our guests, Maya Milan Gonzalez and Malik Mia. As always, a shout out to the hardworking staff at KABU who make all of this possible. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade for a discussion about the social history of reproductive rights in Portland. I'm going to leave you today with a little more from the song Revolution by Arrested Development. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay active.
As I look out my window, I see the little ones playing amongst each other with the water guns in pure poverty. Generations of good people in cycles of poverty. It bothers me, so I ask myself, I say, how you doing as much as you can for the struggle? Am I doing